And that's a really fundamental part of building a good business, is doing the things today that will make it more profitable, make it more attractive to your customers, your suppliers, your investors, and ultimately whoever buys your business further down the track.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. In today's episode, episode number 46, we're having a conversation with Jeff Green. Now, I should just point out we're not related any particular way, just the same surname. Jeff is the author of The Smart Business Exit, and I have to tell you, if there's one business book you read this year, it's got to be this one. It is a fantastic book about how to exit a business. Now, I understand completely that some of you will be sitting there saying, but I'm not ready to exit my business, I don't intend to exit, or whatever. The point of the book is really about building a business that is both profitable and scalable before being imminently saleable. And so what Jeff talks about is how to unlock the value in your business, how to create a business that is really valuable. And then, of course, he goes through the process of exiting should you need to or want to. In the conversation, we cover a whole variety of different topics. We speak at length about what value actually is and the key drivers of value. We're going to be showing how to build value and how, if you were in the exiting position, how to pass that on to the owner so you get maximum dollar. We're going to be talking about scalability and the importance of scalability for a business that is valuable as well. We're going to be understanding how those value drivers in a business apply to dentistry and how they then lead on to a business that is firstly profitable, but then scalable, meaning that you have not just financially improved the business, but you've also improved the ability for you to take time away from the business and do things that you would rather do, perhaps whether it's holidays or to work on the business. And of course, by creating that kind of business, you absolutely increase the value of your business phenomenally. So we're going to be going through a whole lot of these key areas in the podcast. As always, please have a pen and paper handy because Jeff does drop a lot of value in the conversation and you want to capture that. And of course, as I always say, take it back to your practice and apply it on Monday. In this particular conversation, as I said, it is a preamble because we're going to be seeing more of Jeff at a course that I'm running for my coaching clients. Now, I don't normally open my events up to the general public, but on this particular event, we are opening up a handful of tickets. And so if you'd like to come along and learn how to create a practice that is not just profitable, but is certainly very scalable and very valuable, then you might want to come along and see Jeff and I have a conversation about that. The registration, of course, can be done at drjessegreen.com/nail it. So if that takes your fancy, please head along there and make sure you register as you normally would. So without any further ado, here's Jeff Green. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Jeff Green, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to spend some time with us. How are you going?
Great, Jesse. Great to be on the podcast.
Yeah, look, thanks so much for coming along, as I said. Now, Jeff, you're the author of a book called The Smart Business Exit. And I have to say, firstly, congratulations on the book. I've taken the time to go through it and it is incredibly comprehensive in its approach. And so firstly, well done to you, mate.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse.
You're welcome. As someone who's written a book, I completely understand how much work has gone into that. It's very, very comprehensive. Jeff, the reason I wanted to start with this concept around exit is I know a lot of people listening to this podcast are thinking, why are we talking about business exits? I'm not ready to exit. You know, I'm planning on working for another however many years it might be. Why is exiting something that, you know, everyone should be thinking about now?
Yeah, look, it's probably the key driver behind me writing the book, Jesse. As you know, I've worked as a corporate lawyer and business advisor and also in my own business ventures for 25, 30 years now. And there's been a lot of work around business exits. And the key reason I wrote the book was for years and years and years, I've just seen people, you know, really work hard in their businesses, often for decades. And when they get to the exit, they really don't get rewarded for their blood, sweat and tears. So the book was really a way to try and get a lot of information out to people at an earlier stage in their business career so that they could be thinking about some of the things that will really impact on them when they actually get to their exit. And as you know, the book really looks at all the sorts of things you'll do over the whole business journey of developing your business. And it touches on a lot of the things you can do along the way that'll have a big impact on whether or not you get a successful business exit.
I think one of the key things that I took out of the book, and I know we've had some discussions around this privately, is that, you know, your exit might be a long way off in the future, or it might be more imminent. But equally, I think it's, you know, part of that concept of, you know, thinking about the exit is building your business to sell from the outset, though you may never sell, you may not exit anytime soon, but it's about making sure your business is maximally valued at any given time. How did you kind of think about that as the journey for the business owner as well, you know, as they're going through the journey? What were the sort of processes that you were thinking about as part of that preparation?
Well, I suppose as I was writing the book, I mean, a lot of the focus was on the things that you need to do to maximize getting a successful business exit at the end of your journey. But the more I got into the book, the more I was sort of realizing that a lot of what I was talking about was actually making people's businesses better right now. And that's a really fundamental part of building a good business, is doing the things today that will make it more profitable, make it more attractive to your customers, your suppliers, your investors, and ultimately whoever buys your business further down the track.
Okay, so given that we've got a really diverse array of people listening to the podcast, there'll be some people who are, you know, contemplating business ownership. There are some people who are in a practice where they're essentially self-employed, and there are other people who are either, you know, scaled in their operations or, you know, what I call true business ownership, and there'll be some wanting to transition to that. Where do you see, you know, obviously you've seen, you know, all sorts of businesses, and, you know, are business owners, you know, created equally, or are they all the same? Are they all cast from the same die, or do they come in different shapes and sizes and different flavors, if you will?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different types of business owners out there. And one model that I thought might be useful to share with your listeners today is one that I picked up from a guy I do a lot of work with, a guy called John Warrilow, who wrote a book called Built to Sell, which is a terrific book. I recommend it to your readers. John has this really simple model that he uses that's really, really good, I think. So he looks at business owners falling into three broad camps. So he talks about mountain climbers, who are your classic entrepreneurs who will do absolutely anything to reach their goal as an entrepreneur. So they'll quite happily take on investors, they'll take huge risks, they'll take on a lot of debt, they'll do anything to achieve their business goal. And they're probably in the minority. And then you have his second category, which he talks about, which are freedom fighters. And they're your classic employees who get to a point where they're just sick of working for somebody else and they want to go off and do their own thing. And the key thing that defines them, and I suspect quite a few of your listeners will fall into this camp, is they want to do things their own way. So they want to build their own business. They want to do it their way. They want to feel like they've got control over their business and their destiny. And their businesses tend to be very much built around their personality and what they want to do. And then there's the third category, which is probably the most common in terms of business owners generally, which is your master crafts person, who's somebody who is very, very good at what they do. And the reason they go into business is that they like to excel at what they do, whether they're a carpenter or a plumber or a doctor, lawyer, whatever. And they get a lot of satisfaction out of doing a good job. The challenge for master craftsmen is that they really like to do the work. And often it can be a challenge for them to scale. So, look, there's all sorts of different ways you can look at who you are as a person and who you are as a business owner. But I think those three models are really useful to look at. And if you have a good understanding of which one of those three categories you're likely to fit into, it will really help you kind of get a handle on the sorts of things you need to do in your business. So if you're perhaps a master craftsperson, you might want to look for a partner in your business who might be more of a freedom fighter or a mountain climber if you want to actually end up with a bigger business.
Okay, so I guess for each of those three categories, there's going to be some challenges and opportunities for each of them, as you already pointed out with the master craftsperson. But if you're a freedom fighter or indeed a mountain climber, where do you see the potential opportunities lying for those sorts of people? And equally, where do you see some of the challenges or hurdles that those other two groups would have to overcome?
Yeah, I think if you're a mountain climber, you really are that classic entrepreneur who is just totally focused on achieving a certain outcome. It's risky though, you know, and I've done a lot of work with a lot of mountain climber entrepreneur types over the years, and they tend to break through or crash. There's usually not much in between because they will take big risks to get to where they want to get. They'll also dust themselves off quickly and do it all over again. Freedom fighters, I think, is a really interesting category because it's very much around doing your business your own way, but they don't so much like to get, say, external investors in their business. They get uncomfortable when their business gets beyond a certain size. But if you understand what your mindset is as a freedom fighter, you can build a great business and you can build a business that's very attractive further down the track for somebody else to buy because you tend to focus very much on building something that's very much what you want to do and how you want to do it.
Cool. So we're just coming back to freedom fighters, because I think you're right when you said that a fair portion of the audience listening to this show will probably fall into that category. With that kind of freedom fighter mentality, do most freedom fighter type business owners end up with a business that is effectively a self-employment situation, or do they have the same opportunity to create some leverage or scalability in their practice that obviously the mountain climbers are going to, that's where they're going to be heading, and the master craftsmen are kind of not going to be heading. But does the freedom fighter typically leverage and scale, or do you find most of them kind of end up as the kind of owner operator, mum and dad corner store operation?
Look, it's probably more the master craftsman who tends to be sort of self-employed because often they, you know, really what they want to do is the work in a really hands-on way. So they will always gravitate to doing the work because that's what they get their satisfaction out of. So they'll often have trouble employing more than two or three people to work with them. Freedom fighters are quite good at building up teams because they want to build a business as opposed to getting their primary satisfaction out of just doing the work. But they'll often only want to build a business to a certain level. So unlike perhaps a mountain climber who might have no hesitation in moving somebody along who they think's not up to the job in the business, freedom fighters will often have a workforce around them that have been with them for a long time. They're sort of more like family than employees sometimes. So sometimes they, you know, you need to look at being a bit more self-disciplined as a freedom fighter and saying, well, you know, you have to make some hard decisions in your business sometimes, which they can often find uncomfortable because that's not consistent with who they are.
Yeah, cool. I think that's really insightful. And I think you're right. There'll be a lot of people on the show who really fit that mold very, very neatly. I wanted to just turn the conversation to business value because, you know, you introduced the concept of an exit, and you also introduced the concept that when you're working with people to, you know, structure their exit at the end, you found that their business improved dramatically along the way as well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about value and, you know, essentially understanding what value is and, you know, the components that make up value, how you can build it, and of course, you know, in the case of an exit, how you transition that value to the new owner. But we'll come to that a bit last. But can you just give us a bit of an overview of how you define business value and then the key things that drive it?
Yeah, sure. Look, business value is a concept that's probably been the major fascination of my working life. I've been lucky over the years to work with a lot of entrepreneurs on high growth companies, a lot around commercializing innovation. And a lot of it's really been about building business value and then exiting well. So I've always been fascinated by the whole concept of what is the essence of value in a business, because I don't think many people actually think about it all that much. And your typical business owner probably looks at their business in quite different ways at different stages. So while they're running it, I often sort of say that business owners think about their business as an ATM, because it's what produces the cash, it's what funds their lifestyle. It's effectively their ATM. They don't often think about it much as being something that has an intrinsic value in its own right. And then one day they wake up and go, oh, well, I've had enough now, I want to sell it. So all of a sudden they want their ATM to turn into a valuable asset that somebody else wants to buy. And lo and behold, that doesn't always happen by accident. And quite often you can have quite a profitable business that is actually not that valuable to somebody else.
So that's really interesting. So I guess the point around that is profit is only one component of the value, right?
Correct. Yeah. And I mean, a classic example of that would be, you know, I know a few, you know, extremely good consultants who get paid, you know, enormous amounts of money for what they do because they're just very, very good at it. But they're basically lone wolves. They have no infrastructure. They have no systems. It's just what they bring into a room. You know, so you can have somebody earning $1 million a year, but the minute they go to sell it, there's actually nothing to sell. So you can have something that as an ATM's highly valuable, but as a business to sell, it's worth virtually nothing. And that's obviously an extreme example. I think the other thing about value too is, having done many, many exits, value is very much in the eyes of the beholder. So every potential buyer of your business will put a different value on your business because they see different things in it. They see value in it that you don't see. They see problems in it that you don't see. And they'll all approach it differently depending on why they want to buy your business. So that's sort of, I guess, a more macro view. And then I think it's, you know, really looking at your business, and I often say to people, look at it, try to look at it through the eyes of a buyer because they're the ones who will potentially write a check out. So what's the value in your business? Is it you? Is it some unique IP? Is it your customer base? Is it your market positioning? Is it the systems and processes you've got in place? Because that's where the real value is, and you need to look past the financials and look at, you know, where is the underlying value in the business that somebody else will pay good money for.
It's a really interesting thing there, Jeff, as well, because the times that I've sold a business, you know, it was the IP that actually got us the money in the end. It was the systems and processes. And you're quite right, I hadn't really studied business value at that point. I thought it was going to be the cash flow, but it really wasn't. It was the fact that there was IP that de-risked the transaction, and that's what people paid for. So I guess there's a whole variety of different things there.
And one of the biggest issues for a buyer is how they actually make sure they get the value in the business transitioned to them. And if we've got a moment, I've actually got an interesting little anecdote on transferring value. Quite a few years ago, I was working for a large manufacturing company that bought another large manufacturing company. It was quite a big deal at the time. It was about $40, $50 million. And they knew when they bought this company that at some stage they'd need to upgrade all its manufacturing facility and so on. And when they went in, they sort of went in pretty hard in terms of rationalising staff and all the rest of it. And they let go three guys who were getting towards the end of their career, who were, you know, right down in the manufacturing plant. And these guys were your classic overalls and coffee scroll and meat pie guys who really didn't do very much but just were around. And they formed a view through the deal that they didn't really need these three guys anymore, so they saved themselves $150,000 on payroll. But I was talking to them a few months afterwards, and they said, we made a huge mistake letting those guys go because it turns out that, you know, the manufacturing line was really in pretty bad shape. And the only three people in the whole business who actually knew how to fix it on the spot or knew who to get in to fix it were these three guys. And it cost them millions because they had to bring forward a whole lot of capital expenditure to upgrade the manufacturing line and all the rest of it. And it was a classic case of some value sitting in the business that nobody actually realised. It was a value sitting in these guys' heads, basically. And a classic case of actually not identifying value and then letting it go. And then in this case, you know, quite substantial consequences from doing that. So, you know, getting the value is a big issue, both for the buyer trying to make sure they get it and the seller making sure that they've identified what the buyer actually needs and making sure they get it.
And equally, I think if that business hadn't been sold and the original vendor retained the business, I mean, surely that would also represent key person risk as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a classic case in larger businesses, particularly older businesses that perhaps haven't been systematized a lot. A lot of your knowledge about the business is actually in people's heads. And it's one of the hardest things to actually transfer when you come to sell your business.
Do you have any, I guess, tips for the audience? Like if they've got people in their business who have been there for, you know, 10, 15 years or, you know, whatever time frame, and they have this knowledge in their head, my approach is always to get them to write everything down. But is there anything beyond that that they can and should be doing to make sure that they minimise or mitigate that risk?
I think it's a couple of things. I mean, one is, as you said, making sure that you do actually systematise your business and make sure all the things that are fundamental to making the business operate are actually recorded in some sort of way so someone else can pick it up. But the other aspect is making sure that you don't become too dependent on one person, so that you try and make sure that, you know, with key roles, there's always, you know, particularly in larger organisations, always two or three people who can easily step into that role. Because you get the classic case where, and we've all heard it many times where people will say, I just couldn't run the business without Mary. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
And she probably is. But that's exactly what a buyer's going to think too. Well, what if Mary doesn't come across or resigns the day after I buy the business? And she is, in fact, fundamental to the business. So I think those two things combined, making sure that you systematise it and record it, and also that there's never just one person who can do a critical task in your business.
Yeah, we talk about in our organisation having bench warmers or understudies, if you will. And so for those key roles, we try and always have an understudy. And much like going to the theatre, you know, you go to see The Phantom of the Opera and Anthony Warlow's Crook that night, well, someone's got to step in and do it.
And I think there's also some cultural aspects to that as well, because, you know, I find in a lot of organisations, particularly as they get bigger, that there's often some empire building goes on. Yeah. And some people actually like to create a situation where the business is very dependent on them. And often they do it for not the wrong reasons, but they do build little empires. So I think you need to work on the culture so that it's regarded as being, you know, an important component of the organisation's culture, that you do have, as you say, people on the bench and multitasking and so on, so that your organisation's never fully dependent on one or two key people.
Cool. So what I wanted to explore for a moment, Jeff, is we've spoken a bit about business value and we've spoken about, you know, transferring and some of the risks and whatnot. But in terms of how you kind of break down value, if someone said, look, I want to increase the value of my business, I think that's going to be a good thing to do, even though I'm not exiting. What would be the things to focus on in terms of building a business that's, you know, highly saleable in the event that it's sold at some point? But equally something that's able to be scaled?
With a lot of the work that I do, as you know, Jesse, I focus a lot on sort of eight key value drivers that really drive the value of businesses. And those value drivers are very much focused on exit value. But what flows from them is you're actually building a better business as you're going along. So a couple of those, you know, just to touch on them briefly, one of them's a value driver called hub and spoke, which is around the idea that a lot of businesses get totally dependent on the business owner. So they're kind of the hub and there are all these spokes coming off the business owner, and everything that happens in the business always needs to go back to the business owner. And a lot of businesses operate that way, and it's very easy to end up operating that way. But when you do, you're putting a brake on your ability to actually build your business. So your business is very much just you, no matter how many employees you've got, because you're always at the center of everything. So I really spend a lot of time working with business owners around what are the things that you don't need to be involved in, that you can be comfortable that you've got the systems and processes and staff in place for those things to run without your involvement. Because sure enough, when you come to sell, you know, particularly if you're a larger business, a buyer's going to say, well, I think the business is still heavily reliant on you, Jesse, so we'd like you to hang around for 2 or 3 years, and we might actually make your purchase price contingent upon you being around and making sure that we're actually satisfied we've got the full value before we let you go. And you really don't want to be in that situation unless, you know, you choose to be. You actually want to have the choice about whether you do that or not. So the more you can make sure that the business can run without you, the more valuable you actually make it, you know, as you go along. It lets you do good things like have holidays and that sort of stuff. But it also is, you know, bit by bit building more exit value in your business at the same time.
Yeah. And look, the couple of things that come up there, Jeff, that, you know, just as what I'm hearing you say, is the bottleneck's usually or almost always at the top of the bottle. And the other thing that comes up as we talk about that is, I know, you know, in the past, you know, the traditional business models for dentistry have been, you know, really around owner-operator style businesses, where the practice owner is also the guy on the tools who's, you know, delivering great care to patients, you know, by day and running the business by night. But what I'm hearing you say is that's clearly a case of hub and spoke kind of stuff. And ultimately, that's going to put the brakes on business growth, business development. And for a business owner, a dental practice owner, to be able to extricate themselves out of that role, they're going to need to carve out some time where they're able to think more critically about the business, delegate things, have those systems in place, and ultimately build a team to deliver great outcomes for patients rather than the business owner themselves delivering outcomes. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, correct. And I think part of that comes back to the type of business owner you are. So if you're more of a freedom fighter, style business owner, then you might be more comfortable with doing less time on the tools and really trying to build your business up with a range of people working for you. But if you're more of a craftsperson, master craftsperson in mindset and inclination, you might need to look at the fact that you do need to spend some time on the tools. It might be something you get a lot of satisfaction out of. So you need to sort of look at, well, maybe I need to spend a third of my time, you know, still attending to patients because I get a lot of satisfaction out of that. And it might be you like working on the more difficult cases or the more complex sort of cases because that's what you get your most satisfaction from. Because I've seen some people who get a lot of satisfaction out of doing the work try and step completely out of it and then getting very, very dissatisfied doing that. So part of this is actually coming back to understanding what you're like as a person and what you need, and also who else you need to bring into the business to help you build it.
I think that's really critical about the know thyself kind of comment there. And, you know, again, there's no one way to do anything, is there? There's many ways to be right. And, you know, as you say, it depends on who you are and what you're trying to achieve. So we've gone through the hub and spoke element of value. What other elements of value would you think would be pertinent, particularly to a dental practice?
Well, I think the other one that's interesting to look at is recurring revenue, because recurring revenue is one of those areas that can add a lot of value to your business, both as you're running it and at exit. And a lot of this really comes back to the quality of the revenue in your business. Because if you look at a business on the one hand that has almost all of its revenue contracted and certain for a, say, a long period of time, a buyer coming into that business will look at it and say, well, that's great, I can see this ongoing revenue stream, which I'm happy to pay for. But if at the other end of the spectrum, all of your income is effectively contingent upon your day-to-day marketing activities or just who walks in the door, that's much, much less certain, and a buyer's not going to pay as much. And that's also around the comfort of running your business too, because it's a lot more comfortable running your business if you can see recurring revenue coming in for months ahead and you know exactly where you're at. You can forecast accurately. You know how much business development you need to do relative to working with your clients and so on. So a business that's got more recurring revenue is both better in terms of running it day to day, but also much more valuable when it comes to exit. And a lot of the work that I've done, you know, in terms of exits, you know, there's a lot of research that shows that businesses that have higher levels of recurring revenue would generally get higher offers than those that don't.
Yeah, and fair enough too, because it's as you say, it's a predictable stream and the purchaser knows what they're buying. And in dental terms, that really comes down to a couple of key things. Obviously, it comes back to retaining your patient base, which is critical. You know, there's no point marketing and having, you know, patients leak at the practice. It probably comes back to having a really tight recall system, making sure that people are coming in for their, you know, scheduled preventive maintenance appointments. And of course, there's a bit of a shift on at the moment to productizing dental care, and that's, you know, having dental plans and, you know, whether it's, you know, X number of dollars a month and whatever the package might be. So there's plenty of ways that's relevant for dentists as well.
Yeah, and I think dentists are in an interesting sort of category, because there is a natural stickiness to dental patients, because, you know, it is the kind of practice where once people find a good dentist, you know, their tendency is to go back. And I guess the thing, key thing about recurring revenue is the extent to which you can maximise the likelihood that clients are going to come back. I mean, perhaps just give you a quick example on that, pretty simple one. You know, we've got a guy who mows our lawns on a regular basis, and lawn mowing is a classic business where you can actually lock in quite a bit of recurring revenue. And he's a guy, you know, does a great job. He actually mowed them yesterday and they look terrific today. And he's a guy who I would be quite happy to say, well, let's just call him Tim. Tim, can you just come once a month and mow the lawns, and I'll put a direct debit in and I'll just assume you'll turn up and mow the lawns. That would be great. But he never does that. We've always got to call him. So if he went to sell his business, he couldn't say that we were a recurring revenue client. He could say, look, they're probably likely to keep using you, but he hasn't got us locked in any way. And the irony is, you know, we'd probably get our lawn cut every 6 to 8 weeks. If he was on a recurring revenue model, we'd probably get it cut every 4 weeks and he'd make more money out of us. So I think in a lot of businesses that already have a recurring revenue type flavor to them, you can actually take that recurring revenue to a higher level if you just think about it a bit more.
Do you see a lot of businesses that have elements of recurring revenue and then one-off revenue in addition to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, you know, law firms, accounting firms, you know, all sorts of consulting firms, you know, they'll have a mixture of loyal clients who send them pretty regular work, but then they'll have a lot of one-off work as well. But a lot of it's around, you know, I think the way you shape your work with clients, because I think a lot of advisory firms in particular could have a much more locked in sort of arrangement with their clients. The sort of plans that you were talking about a moment ago, where it's more systematized in terms of connecting with your client base and it may be that, you know, you do certain work for them on a regular basis until they tell you they don't want it anymore. And that's where you actually go to a higher quality of recurring revenue.
Yeah. So again, it's that case where not all revenue is created equal, right?
Exactly.
You mentioned a couple of those key areas when it comes to, you know, delivering value in a dental practice would be, you know, the hub and spoke recurring revenue. But we also spoke about, you know, as we're building our practice, as we're building business, we're taking that mentality that we're going to exit one day, even though that day may be, you know, a long way off, as I keep reiterating. But the outcome of that is by building it to sell now, A, we're preparing for that day, but equally improving the enjoyment, quality, profitability of our business now. But why is it so important? You know, I have heard you speak before and you say it's important to think like a buyer. What exactly do you mean by that, and why does that matter?
Yeah, I think just on the issue of the importance of thinking about having a highly sellable business, I think one thing that some people overlook is the fact that even if you don't think you're going to sell your business anytime soon, circumstances can change very, very quickly. And, you know, two of the key things that result in people selling their business is a serious health issue to either the owner or someone close to them, or someone just coming and knocking on the door unexpectedly saying, I'd like to buy your business. And almost by default, you're suddenly in sell mode, although you had no intention of selling. And the things, and let's take the first example. Say you compared, say, a typical owner of a dentistry practice with, say, somebody who was working in a highly paid job and maybe earning similar sorts of income, but not building a business asset. Say something actually happened to each of those people. The likelihood is the person who's employed earning a good income, they've probably been putting money away in super. It's probably in things like, you know, blue chip shares, property, etc. So their spouse who's left, obviously there's a tragedy around the person dying, but the partner who's left is actually in a strong position in the sense that there are assets there that have suffered no diminution in value because of the event and are liquid and all the rest of it. But if you take a business owner, if you're, you know, married to a business owner who suddenly has a major heart attack and the business needs to be sold, quite often they haven't got money in super. Most of their wealth's tied up in the business. And all of a sudden, the value of that business will automatically decline instantly if they're the key person in the business and they haven't built a sellable business. So the consequences can be dramatically different. And that's why I always sort of say you need to try and have a mentality of building a highly sellable business. So if you did suddenly decide you wanted to sell, it's easy to sell. Or if, you know, worst case scenario, something really bad happened in your life where you had to sell it, again, it's easy to sell. So that's one of the reasons why I really emphasize, even if you have no intention of selling anytime soon, every now and again, you have circumstances where you get pushed into it. So I digressed a little from your question on thinking like a buyer. The reason I often sort of say to people that you, as you're building your business, you should always try and think like a buyer, because when you're running your own business, often you can't see the wood for the trees. You're buried in the detail, you're buried in the day-to-day, and you're not actually thinking about what your business looks like to a buyer. And as we've discussed offline previously, Jesse, there's lots of really interesting things happening in the health sector generally and in the dentistry sector where we're seeing, you know, people coming into the marketplace who weren't there, you know, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. So the sort of people that are potentially looking at making a play in, you know, in the health sectors has changed dramatically over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. So in terms of thinking about, you know, where who you might actually sell your practice to further down the track, you need to be thinking about sort of quite different buyers. So, you know, if you compared with, you know, say an insurance company that might want to, you know, buy some dental practices compared with a traditional fellow dentistry practitioner, what they're looking for is going to be very different. So just trying to think about, you know, what value do particular types of buyers see in your business? What things would they like to have in place to want to pay you more money than less? You know, those sorts of things. So, and it's really a mindset, trying to always think like a buyer.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because I think, you know, just I'm recalling a conversation I had with the CEO of one of the major corporations. I won't mention her name, but when I had a conversation with this particular chap, he was talking about how they'd been going about sourcing practices and their growth was through a combination of acquisition and greenfield sites. And he made a comment to me, just as an aside, that his comment to me is the problem with most dentists is where they've got a, you know, a small corner store kind of practice, you know, what we would have seen as a suburban dental practice, you know, maybe two or three dental chairs. And, you know, really his comment was at the end of the day, they don't have much to sell. And that really ties in with what you're saying there is thinking like a buyer. And I guess, as you say, you've got to identify the most likely buyer. So, you know, the mum and dad, you know, operation on, you know, suburban dental practice is going to attract perhaps another mum and dad kind of operator as well, but it's not going to have that broad appeal to a variety of different buyers. So what I'm hearing you say, Jeff, is as you go about building your business, I guess it's a point of not just identifying the most likely buyer for what your business currently is, but equally thinking, okay, if I was going to sell my practice and I wanted to get top dollar for it, who's the person who could pay top dollar? What sort of things would they be looking for? And then how do I go about the process of building that in the time that I have while I'm operating the business? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, correct. And I think just having that mindset of thinking like a buyer, part of it's looking at what you do as you're running your business as well. And look, I always encourage business owners to make sure they get out and about, you know, get involved in their industry associations, get along to, you know, conferences now and again, and just talk to a wider range of people than perhaps they would normally. Because it really is interesting in different industries just seeing quite different players coming in. And quite often players coming in from effectively outside the industry have quite different sort of agendas and are looking for different things. So if you can position yourself to be attractive, you know, relative to your peers, for somebody that's perhaps coming in with, you know, a good checkbook to open up, you know, you can get quite a different sort of outcome. But you need to really understand what are the opportunities they're seeing in your sector, what are some of the threats that they may be dealing with that they're trying to use an acquisition to deal with, and so on. And I think in the health sector in particular, you know, we've seen a lot of corporatisation of particularly GP practices, and I think we're now really starting to see that trend rippling out into allied health industry areas as well. So I don't see any sign that it's going to stop. I also see a lot of serious money in the background that's available to fund these sort of things, because the health sector generally, you know, is seen as a real growth sector, I think, in the Australian marketplace at the moment.
Well, the ageing demographic.
Yeah, which means there is some, you know, serious money starting to, you know, be available to do things in the health sector. And I'm certainly doing a few things in other, you know, parts of the health industry, which are really being driven by those sorts of trends.
Yeah, cool. And I guess one of the things as well, Jeff, what I'm hearing you say is keeping your eyes open, keeping your crystal ball polished and ready to be able to anticipate the trends, see the future, and understand the market forces at play.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. Mate, I wanted to just finish our conversation with a bit of a discussion about what an exit actually looks like from the point of view of, obviously, there's the price to consider, there's, you know, preparation, you know, involved, you know, what happens with buyers, costs, advisors, and so on. Can, for someone who was listening and saying, this sounds great, I understand I need to build it to sell it, but I'm actually close to selling, yeah, you know, perhaps there's someone who is thinking about exiting, what sort of advice would you have for them?
Yeah, look, I think the key thing is that they start preparing earlier rather than later. Over the years, you know, the most common thing I see is people starting too late, and often that's because their exit is precipitated by something else, not them. You know, a health issue or someone knocking on the door, or sometimes they've just waited too long. And I particularly see this with older business owners who just one day wake up and the, you know, the hunger and desire to run the business just suddenly isn't there anymore. And you don't want to be selling in that mindset. You actually want to be exiting while you almost at the top of your game. So I really encourage people to, try and start preparing early. Now, one of the problems with that is there's actually not much information around about how to actually prepare for an exit, which again was one of the reasons why I wrote my book, The Smart Business Exit. But I'd really encourage people to start talking to, their accountants, their lawyers, start looking for, there are a few good books out there now on business exits, but up until recently, there haven't been many. So try and source, a good book or two and just have a read of it just to get some more knowledge around the exit. Because the thing is, compared with everything else you do in your business, which you do over and over again, most people only ever do one or two exits. So you don't want to be really practicing on your first one. You want to try and learn as much as you can about it, and make sure you get the right advisors on board so that you try and pull it off in the best possible way. So a few of the key, so preparation is one of the key ones. Having an understanding about the actual value of your business and how the price will be determined. And for a lot of private businesses, it's done on a multiple basis, which means that a buyer will look at your profitability and then say, well, I'll pay you a certain multiple for those profits. And the average for, say, a good private business is usually 3 to 4 times profits. Whereas if you can build some more value into your business, it might be more like 5 or 6. So, you really want to focus on trying to get the multiple as high as possible. So say you were making $200,000 a year profit and you can get a multiple of 4, then you're talking about 800,000. If you can get a multiple of 5, you're talking more like 1 million. So working on the quality of your business and getting the multiple up is good. Thinking about the buyers, which we've talked about quite a bit already, and having an idea about who they might be early on. Cost is obviously one issue that a lot of people want to know about. I generally say as a rule of thumb that you should be factoring in overall costs of somewhere between 5 and 10% of your sale price. And that'll be a mixture of fees for your advisors, so your lawyer, your accountant. Normally, your business broker or corporate advisor will charge you on a percentage basis for the transaction, which only becomes payable if you actually do the transaction. And then you obviously have tax and other things to factor in as well. But it's good to get a handle on that sort of stuff early, because I find a lot of sellers going into a transaction focus on the headline number of what they're going to sell their business for. And I always say to them, well, make sure you factor in tax, make sure you factor in advisor fees and so on, because the headline number, once it's had some deductions to it, might be quite a bit less than you actually want for your business. And then probably the other key factor is just making sure you get the right advisory team in place. Normally you're going to have your lawyer, your accountant. Depending on the size of your business, you'll either have a business broker or a corporate advisor. And then you might need some, input from specialist advisors like a tax expert or an HR expert, depending on, where your business is at and what other things you might need to do in it. But again, I sort of say to people, spend a bit of time getting your team together. Don't rush around and try and pull a team together in a week or so. Make sure you, when you're heading towards exit, you have a think about the sort of advisors you think you need. And sometimes it's not your day-to-day advisors that have perhaps been with you for a while, and you need to think through how that works in practice as well.
There are so many things to think about there, mate, and obviously there's a whole stack of stuff that we could go on and on and on about, because that's a topic in and of itself, one that I know you're particularly adept at and masterful at. What I really love just to touch on that is, working on that multiple, because, we know that, in small businesses, value is profit by multiple. Obviously working on the profitability we do day in, day out, and in business coaching and all those sorts of things. But one of the things that, we've certainly tried to do with the guys we work with is to focus on the multiple as much as the profit. And we're going to be catching up in February, Jeff, to have a bit of a chat about that. So I'm looking forward to hearing more of what you've got to say about that. So that'll be terrific.
Yep, me too, Jesse.
It should be fun. Listen, mate, I wanted to say on behalf of all the audience today, thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to come and spend some time with us. And there's a lot of gold that you've shared with us there, mate. And I've been scribbling madly, making notes for myself as well. And, again, I just want to say thanks so much for taking the time out. I know you're a busy guy. I know you're about to head overseas, and we're looking forward to catching up soon.
Thanks, Jesse. It's been a pleasure being on the podcast.
Thanks, mate. Cheers. Really hope you enjoyed that episode with Jeff Green today. We covered, as you heard, lots of territory there, particularly around creating value in your business, you know, so that your practice is much more valuable now, much more profitable now, but equally at the end of your practicing life, it's eminently more valuable as well. So I hope you got some good notes there that you can take into practice, whether it's about the hub and spoke model, whether it's about creating recurring revenue streams and whatnot. So until next week, have a good week, and we look forward to seeing you then. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.